You are listening to National Security Law Today.
Welcome to National Security Law Today, the podcast of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security. I'm Elisa Poteet. I'm always here in my individual capacity thinking about national security. Do you ever get to thinking about how our differences became so much more obvious, extreme, and political? Years ago, we interviewed Chris Steyerwalt, author of Broken News, who thought that Craigslist had killed local papers, driving people onto cable news, where they fell into ideological silos that thereafter drove them further and more into extreme and negative views and outlooks of our country. Now, if our national security is linked to our unity, what does that mean for Americans? Recently, researchers at MIT and Harvard, Shahed Noy and Akash Rao, looked at available data on television, linear and cable, and made some interesting findings that they published in a paper entitled The Business of the Culture War. Both of the authors of that study, Shahed Noy, a fourth-year PhD student in economics at MIT, and Akash Rao, who studies, gosh, it's like everything, economics, politics, and the media at Harvard. They were nice enough to come in and talk about their findings tonight. So thank you both for being here. Let's start with the basics. What prompted this research? I mean, I'm looking at you guys right now and you're youngish. Linear television, I can't imagine that was really part of your upbringing. And yet you rendered this study, which I think is important to understanding sort of the origins. So what kicked this off?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a growing sense, and I don't think this is a controversial view, that something fundamental has broken in American politics recently. If you look at the discourse around the causes of what's going on, a lot of people tie it to changes in the informational environment, right? The way that we engage with politics, the way that we learn about what's going on in the country is just fundamentally different than, you know, it has been before. A natural impetus is kind of go to think about social media and say, you know, social media is at the root of these changes. And we were curious as to whether is this really social media or is it more about what people demand in their news? Social media is another iteration of a vehicle to deliver what we demand. But, you know, there have been a lot of different types of news technologies, newspapers and radio and broadcast TV and cable TV and internet news. And people have had very similar criticisms about each of these new waves of technology to the criticisms that we're seeing about social media. Part of what we're doing in this paper is arguing that a lot of these things that people think about as associated with social media are actually manifestations of kind of more fundamental preferences of viewers. And so the kind of vehicle that we're studying that in is television news and cable TV in particular.
I'm going to latch on to one thing that you said toward the end of that is sort of what viewers want. I mean, everybody wants to be agreed with. Let's start with that premise. But broadly speaking, Shahed, what were your findings in this regard?
Our focus in this paper is on a distinction between political issues that you might describe as broadly economic, so issues of taxation, regulation, spending, and so on, and issues that you could describe as cultural or identitarian. So think about immigration, crime, policing, racial and gender issues, things like that. And something that's been observed in the political science literature is that over time, the kind of central cleavages in American politics, the issues that divide voters, have shifted from being economic issues around the kind of middle of the 20th century to increasingly in the past 20 or 30 years being cultural issues. And this kind of culture war seems to have precipitated or gone alongside the breakdown in American politics that Akash mentioned. So our main findings in this paper are, firstly, that the cable news networks, Fox News, MSNBC, and CNN, that entered in the 1980s and the 1990s, talk about these culture war issues much more than politicians did and do, and much more than the broadcast news networks that preceded them did. And so the entry of cable news, we show, was kind of dramatically increased the amount of culture war rhetoric and culture war discussion that was in the kind of public political discourse. So the paper really is about the causes of that, which I'm sure we'll talk about, the reasons why cable news talks much more about culture war issues than politicians or than broadcast news networks do. And then about the consequences, and what we show on the consequences side is that it seems like people who are more exposed to cable news, because they're hearing so much about these culture war issues, come to care more about these culture war issues when they're voting. And this in turn causes politicians to talk more about the culture war when they're on the campaign trail. So in broad strokes, our finding is that the entry of cable news, by increasing the amount of culture war rhetoric and culture war discussion in political discourse, increased the importance of those culture war issues and so contributed to the rise of the culture war that dominates politics now.
Within the study itself, oh gosh, how did you define economic issues versus culture war issues? Because among other things, I have to say I was dazzled. You actually wrote your own LLM to sort of parse through the data. You had a lot of help from some of these foundations that collect all the political ads, media content. Talk a little bit about how you define these issues, and then secondarily, how you collected and probed the data to find this, because really it was pretty remarkable, at least in any white paper I've read in a lot of years.
That's kind. You know, I think the thing that modern natural language processing techniques really makes possible is classifying the content of political ads or news segments at a level that's much more granular than we could before. So previously, an approach might be, for example, to look for the word immigrant or look for the word economy or tax in a segment and use that as the basis of classification. What LLMs make possible is classifying not only is this a segment about immigration or is this a segment about the economy, but very specifically, is this, for example, a segment about illegal immigrants committing crimes? Or is this a segment about increasing the top marginal tax rate? And so it's very difficult, for obvious reasons, to define at kind of an abstract level, is this economic or is this cultural? But when you get down to the level of individual issues, it's much easier to make that definition. So, you know, immigration as a topic, is that economic? Is that cultural? Very difficult to say. But if the question is the topic of immigrants changing American culture versus immigrants contributing to the economy, that's a much easier distinction between economic and cultural to make. Part of what we did is just look at how people characterize the culture war, both in popular discourse and academic discourse, identify the issues that people talk about as being part of this cleavage, and look at the issues that are increasingly dividing American voters, and then use that as the basis for classification.
Just out of curiosity, how many years did it take you to pump this out?
I think we started working on this in 2022. Is that right, Chicken?
2023, actually, I think.
2023. Okay. Yeah. It feels like much longer.
You collected massive amounts of data. And I think that in and of itself is worth a mention here. You got cable news content going back to the beginning of these networks.
We have data from the broadcasters back to 1968. And this is just through this amazing project at Vanderbilt, where they have recorded on, you know, physical tapes, because this was back to 1968, the 30 to 60 minutes of national news that these broadcasters were airing every night. And so they have this amazing archive. And so we had to do, you know, very little there. We helped them a little bit with the classification. But other than that, they've really done an amazing work collecting this data. And then we have kind of some more recent transcript data, starting at the introduction of MSNBC and Fox News, both of which are in 1996. And then kind of our main data set for most of our analyses is more recent. So that's from 2014 to 2022. And it's essentially just the full video files of everything that's on cable and broadcast in that, you know, 8-year period. So this is just a public project by this organization called the Internet Archive. They just have a TV recorder, and they record the content of these six networks. And so we can take those video files and we can classify their content.
You noticed there was a distinction between the cable news outlets like Fox and MSNBC and linear network television that we traditionally thought of as the three network system, ABC, NBC, and CBS. Can you talk about those differences and how, if at all, one began to drive the other?
The environment that the broadcast networks operated in, basically from the 1950s to the 1980s, was very different than the media environment that we inhabit today. One way is that there was relatively little competition for attention. So the three kind of broadcast news networks were really the only game in town for this kind of visual audio entertainment. There wasn't much in the way of choice, and so competition for attention wasn't that fierce. These networks also only aired 1 or 2 hours of news every day. If you sort of read historical sources talking about the business strategies of these networks, the goal of their news divisions and of this 1 or 2 hours of primetime news wasn't directly to make money, to raise advertising revenue for the network. It was firstly to just enhance the prestige and reputation of the network in order to attract viewers. And secondly, it was to satisfy regulators. So this was a period where the FCC kind of tightly regulated broadcast television and radio. The idea was basically if you're using the public airwaves to broadcast your content, you have a responsibility to act at least somewhat in the public interest. And the broadcast networks used their primetime news divisions as a way to discharge that obligation. And additionally, they were also regulated by a regulation called the Fairness Doctrine, which required them to present both sides of controversial issues and give airtime to different parties that were mentioned in stories and so on. And so the kind of combination of these incentives to enhance prestige and to satisfy the regulators and to avoid violating the Fairness Doctrine meant that they tended to produce this kind of, you know, pretty dry, straight news that just focused on being high quality and informative. It wasn't perfect. There was a lot of criticism even at the time from media critics that they were prone to sensationalism and things like that, but it was very different from the kind of news that you see later. So then later in the 1980s and 1990s, a couple of things happened. One is that the kind of spread of cable television means that there's suddenly vastly more channels and vastly more entertainment channels available to viewers than there were before. And so that's suddenly a huge intensification in competition. You can't assume that people are going to watch your primetime news anchor discuss the news of the day in kind of a dry and boring tone if they can switch very easily to dozens of reality TV or sports or entertainment channels. So that kind of put pressure on that business model. And the other was that there was the entry of these cable news networks, which were airing 24 hours of news a day, and they were making all of their revenue from the news. So it wasn't like, you know, the broadcast networks where the news was kind of a prestige-generating loss leader that wasn't meant to directly make money. Here, for the cable news networks, they were producing 24 hours of content a day, and they were really trying to attract a lot of attention so that they could make money. And so what we argue in the paper is that it's this difference in economic incentives, and in particular, the incentive of cable news to be much more aggressive in attracting attention and capturing viewers that leads them to focus a lot more on culture war content than the broadcast networks did.
You identify this attention getting strategy. How did you initially identify it? And why don't you explain how it contributed to the polarization exactly? In other words, we sort of all know organically that heightened competition, you know, generated more extreme messages. But what did your data show it did particularly to political polarization?
I would say our results speak to political polarization a little bit indirectly. In particular, the main thing our results speak to are the importance of economic versus cultural issues in politics. Part of what we show in this paper is that cultural issues just tend to be a lot better for grabbing people's attention. We can do that in various different ways, but kind of the most direct is to just look at what happens when someone turns on the TV and there happens to be economics on versus there happens to be culture on. And you basically see that if it's someone talking about guns or religion or abortion or free speech or patriotism or these kind of culture war issues, people tend to stay on the channel and watch a lot longer than if it's someone talking about taxation or redistribution or public spending. And so that's kind of one way to just directly show that this business model of focusing on culture war issues works. It keeps people watching TV. It keeps them watching advertisements on the channel. As a result of that, if you believe that cable networks are following this business model, then what that means is that people are just exposed to a lot more culture post-cable than they were pre-cable. So they see these culture war issues on TV, And what our results show is that this leads them to prioritize those cultural issues more heavily when voting. And so they're more likely to vote on the basis of their beliefs on immigration or crime or gender, and less likely to vote on the basis of their beliefs about, what should the tax rate be and how much redistribution should there be and what kind of healthcare system should we have. The way in which this speaks to polarization, kind of the extent to which people on different parties like one another, for example, is that, I think it's pretty intuitive to believe that I dislike someone who has different views on religion or abortion or gender more than I dislike someone who has different views on what should the top marginal tax rate be. And so, we can show some evidence for that, but that's kind of the sense in which this economic versus cultural divide maps on pretty naturally to this question of affective polarization in politics.
Well, I'm not saying I would bet you dollars against donuts that 75% or more of Americans couldn't say what the top marginal tax rate is or even what that means, because they do only have so much time. And if their attention is diverted to these kinds of emotionally provocative, perhaps dopamine-triggering topics, then that's disappointing. And, I also, as I read your study, and I want to respond directly to what you said right now, I also had to wonder, if a national system of education, I know this is like verboten, but a national system of education where certain standards and understandings more in the nature of an IB or more like what you would see in a place like Japan wouldn't benefit and eliminate a lot of this and perhaps make it less culturally okay to be spending that amount of your attention, if you think of it as a wallet, with only so much cash in it, distracted by these non-substantive, provocative cultural issues that may cause people to miss something very important in the economic discourse that could have a much bigger impact on them than any of the things being discussed. Shaked, the business strategy you identify is one that I've suspected. How did the business strategy alone, contribute to our polarization? What did the bottom line do to drive this and make it worse?
Right. So what we argue is the distinctive business strategy of cable news compared, for example, to broadcast news, is that cable news in our data seems to try much harder to compete with non-news alternative viewing options like entertainment channels. So rather than trying to attract viewers from other news channels, cable news is trying really hard to attract viewers who would otherwise watch entertainment or turn off the TV. What we show in the paper is that culture war content seems to be better for this than economic content. So what we show is that when a news channel kind of switches abruptly from talking about economic content to talking about culture war content, it gains a lot of viewers who otherwise would have switched away to watching entertainment, but it loses viewers to competing news channels who are kind of alienated by the culture war news content and switch to competing news channels to get more substantive news. So the distinctive business strategy of cable news in the paper is this attempt to compete with entertainment channels, and the term we use is mobilize new viewers who otherwise wouldn't participate in watching the news, rather than poaching viewers away from competitor news channels. And this is what we argue is behind the focus of cable news on culture war issues.
So, what was the first year of data that you collected from MSNBC and Fox? Because I think of those as sort of the two, and I liked you focused on those two as sort of the mainstream, if you will, cable networks, MSN and Fox. And why did you pick those years?
The first year for which we have full video data, which is the core of our analysis, is 2014. We have data on all six channels, so the three broadcasters, ABC, CBS, NBC, and then the three cable channels, Fox, MSNBC, and CNN. And exactly as you say, there's a lot of work both in various disciplines of communications and media studies and economics, showing that, MSNBC is consistently more liberal, Fox News is consistently more conservative. Now, it's also the case that the influence of Fox News, just the number of people watching Fox News, is much greater than the number of people watching MSNBC or CNN. And that was true in 2014, that was true in 2004, that's true in 2024. So Fox News has always consistently attracted a much greater audience than CNN or MSNBC.
How did survey respondents change over the years that you studied in terms of their identification of culture issues and the importance it plays in politics. You sort of said some basic response to this, but did this in turn sort of become a tail wagging the dog situation where it sort of metastasized into actual politics?
Yeah, so what we see in our data is that over time, culture war issues seem to become more important to voters, and there are different ways of measuring that. One way is that Gallup has for a long time asked people just in an open-ended way, what's the most important problem facing the country? And if you look at answers to that question, more people over time are naming kind of partisan culture war issues. So things like immigration, terrorism, family values from Republican respondents, and things like gun control and gay rights and racism from Democratic respondents. Another way of measuring the importance of culture war views to people is looking at how predictive people's views on economic and cultural issues are for the way they vote. So it used to be the case that if you classify people as economically liberal versus conservative and culturally liberal versus conservative, their kind of economic liberalism was more predictive of how they voted than their cultural liberalism. But increasingly over the past few decades, that has flipped. And now people's cultural liberalism is more predictive of whether they vote Democrat or Republican than their economic liberalism. And that is actually what's underlied the kind of widely discussed fact that Democrats now, much of their base consists of highly educated voters who tend to be very culturally liberal, but economically are more of a mixed bag. While Republicans, more of their base consists of voters without college degrees, who tend to be more culturally conservative, but actually a little bit more economically left-wing. So there are those indications, basically, that the importance of culture war issues are growing over time. And what we show in the paper is that actually, if you really break things down at a very granular issue-by-issue level, you look at specific issues like immigration and gun control and things like that, the issues that are growing the most in importance over time are also the issues that are most emphasized in cable news compared to their emphasis in the preceding generations of broadcast news. So basically, cable news enters, it increases the emphasis on a certain set of issues, and then we see in subsequent years that the importance of those issues to people in political surveys seems to be growing. In terms of how that then affects politics and politicians, we have this big data set of all the campaign advertisements that politicians air when they're campaigning for office. And what we see is that in the 1990s, you see the entry of cable news and the prevalence of these culture war issues in the news starts to grow. And then in the 90s and the 2000s, the importance of these issues to voters is growing. And then starting around the early 2010s, you start to see the prevalence of culture war rhetoric in political advertisements beginning to rise. So it seems to be following these changes that were kickstarted first by cable news and then kind of percolated through the voting public and eventually made their way to politicians who responded to the changing preferences of the public.
We've spoken of this in sort of broad terms, but what did the data show about the contribution to agenda setting that is occurring through what you've observed?
In terms of cable news and agenda setting, I think what we're showing is, you know, political scientists use the term agenda setting to refer to issues that dominate elections and the issues that elections become about. What our study suggests quantitatively is that the more that people watch cable news, the more that they care about culture war issues. And this then causes politicians to respond by supplying more culture war rhetoric. And so cable news are the ultimate agenda setters in this picture of the world. One important thing to note is that, you know, according to our story, cable news is doing this because it's responding to a preference that viewers have for watching culture war content. So it's not that cable news just entered and was like, you know, we want to make politics about culture war issues. That's the objective that we care about. So we're just going to talk a lot about the culture war. The kind of model of the world is that people have this latent preference to pay attention to news that is very conflictual or inflammatory or attention grabbing and tends to be about these kinds of cultural disputes that really pull people in. And the cable news networks were the first entities with the kind of economic incentives and the ability to respond to these preferences and to supply the kind of content that these preferences latch onto. So the picture of the world is basically voters have these preferences, and then cable news enters, and they start to set the agenda for politics by supplying this kind of content and attracting large numbers of viewers.
So, you know, it's us. It's not some diabolical puppet master who is pushing down this message. You know, one of the things that I always think about in these studies is sort of the vintage of the individuals that might be consuming news. And I know that, I didn't see a whole lot of that really become a focus of your study, but it does strike me. And it certainly was one of the comments that Chris Steyerwald made, who didn't do anything like this, but just wrote a book based on his observations and experiences working in media, that he felt that cable news was aging for sure, and linear television was aging, and certainly more rural was the other observation. But you had to have considered some confounds in this study, because anything like this could go topsy-turvy. Talk a little bit about the confounds. And did you have concerns that there was anything out there that might render your study a little less exact? And how did you account for those?
You know, I think the nature of any empirical study of this form, which is trying to link economic forces to long-term secular political trends, is going to be that there are a whole bunch of things going on and you can never control perfectly for all of them. For example, you know, audience composition of cable news is changing. Some of that is a confound. Some of that is also exactly part of the story, that the people who are watching cable news are changing, and cable news is changing their content to meet that demand. But, you know, of course, so much happens since the entry of cable news. You know, Fox and MSNBC are in 1996. This is a period when the Cold War has just ended. And so there's a big shift of focus in politics from international national security concerns back to the domestic agenda. You know, 5 years later is 9/11. And then there's kind of a shift back to international events and terrorism and counterterrorism. You know, 2008 is the great financial crisis. Around this time, you have the introduction of social media. So there's just a huge amount of different things happening during this time. And so our approach is to try to control for those as best we can, use the fact that some media markets are more exposed to cable than other media markets, and try to compare media markets that are more versus less exposed to get at these effects. And then also, part of the point we're making is that there are some aspects of this that are distinctive to cable, but it's really a much more general economic mechanism. It's new technologies that make it easier for news producers to tap into viewers' demand for different types of content are going to result in news producers producing this kind of content, and those will end up having political spillovers. Those will end up changing viewers' behaviors in the voting booth. You know, when we think about social media here, I think a lot of these same forces apply just as well, or perhaps even more strongly, to social media, right? Social media is kind of refining some of these steps that cable news started in terms of targeting specific demographics and in terms of customizing what they're talking about in order to appeal to people's preferences. And in fact, if you think about cable news as taking the first step of looking at these ratings and say, you know, what type of content is working well, what's engaging people, social media is doing that on steroids, right? So they have not only much greater processing power, but also the ability to analyze this content at the second or even more granular levels and really customize it to individuals. You can think about social media as a confound, but I think a lot of it is just another example of exactly the economic forces that we're studying.
And another thing to add on to that, just because it's neat, is that, you know, one of the confounds that you might be worried about at a study like this is we see, people who watch cable news care more about culture war issues than people who don't. But that doesn't mean that cable news is causing them to care more about those issues. Maybe they're watching cable news precisely because they care about those issues and they want to hear about them. And so, as Akash alluded to, one thing we do in the paper, we borrow this technique that was originally developed by the political scientist and economist Greg Martin and Ali Urukoglu. And what they observed is that basically in different places in the U.S., for kind of arbitrary historical reasons, the cable news channels like Fox News were assigned different positions in the channel ordering. So in some places, Fox News is higher up in the channel ordering than it is in other places. And because all of the kind of main big channels that people like to watch tend to get clustered down on the lower end of the channel orderings, Somebody who's just flipping between channels on the lower end of the channel ordering is more likely to stop on Fox News and watch Fox News if Fox News is lower down in the channel ordering compared to if it's higher up in the channel ordering. And so what Greg Martin and Ali Yerkoglu originally showed is that if you look at areas where, for just kind of arbitrary reasons, Fox News was assigned a lower channel number, more people watch Fox News. And so you can use this essentially to then ask, okay, what are the effects of Fox News on various outcomes? Because this variation in the channel position of Fox News is giving you sort of random variation or variation unrelated to local conditions in how many people are watching Fox News. Originally, what Greg Martin and Ali Yerkoglu did was showed that in areas where, for this reason, more people watch Fox News, they showed that more people vote Republican. What we show in the paper is that in areas where more people watch Fox News and MSNBC for this reason, more people report culture war issues in responses to Gallup surveys and show these signs of caring more about culture war issues. So that, for example, is one of the ways that we try to eliminate these potential confounds.
I wonder, have you both from this begun to think a little bit more about the law at all, other than more regulation and sort of putting your thumb on economics and whether it's supply or demand? Have you thought about legal changes that might prompt a reversal of this course?
I think a lot of political scientists would agree that campaign finance regulation would help in kind of stemming the tide of polarization. I think one interesting thing, if you think about the media, is that it's not obvious that campaign donations are the main channel through which very wealthy people or corporations can exert their political influence. It used to be the case that when you were a candidate campaigning, the main lever you had to attract support was buying broadcast television spots where you could get your message out to voters that way. And in that kind of world, raising a lot of money to buy these broadcast TV ads is really important, and therefore campaign donations are very important, and the people who are in a position to provide campaign donations wield a lot of influence. But in a world where candidates have to drum up their own attention on social media or on other forms of media, it's less clear, firstly, that campaign funding is important, and there are more avenues through which Elon Musk's acquisition of Twitter has had an enormous effect on US politics, and I think in particular on discourse within the Republican coalition through the ways that he's intervened to change the algorithm of that website and to bring back accounts that were previously banned. Similarly with attempts by the Ellisons to take over television networks and things like that.
And TikTok.
Yeah, now trying to acquire TikTok as well. So there are lots of avenues through which money can influence politics now that aren't campaign donations. It certainly seems like broader attempts, you know, broader than just regulating campaign finance donations to reduce the influence of wealthy people and of money in politics would be beneficial. I think, though, that one of the insights of economics and of political economy of people like Dorona Semoglu, who won the Nobel Prize in economics last year, is that laws and regulations aren't just things that kind of hang outside of politics and that you can toggle and then they affect politics, but rather they interact with and are jointly determined with politics. And so a law that can restrain polarization in one case can be weaponized by polarized actors in another. A law that is operative on the books can just be ignored by people who control enough branches of government to do that. Politics is this kind of interlocking set of norms and institutions and laws and public opinion and the willingness of the public to act. You really have to be in an equilibrium where all of these things are reinforcing each other in a mutually beneficial way, rather than an equilibrium where they're all reinforcing each other in a bad way. And if you're in the bad kind of equilibrium, like we seem to be now, it's hard to think about just tweaking one thing in a way that will improve the whole situation.
Building off of Shaked's discussion of the effects of media ownership, there's been a lot of discussion of breaking up big media companies, right? We've seen this has been an age of tremendous media consolidation, and it's going to presumably become even more so with the acquisition of TikTok and a lot of these mergers of major broadcasters and TV stations. It's not clear that enforcing the kinds of regulations that have been discussed recently, or creating new regulations that increased competition in the media sphere are going to solve the kinds of problems that we worry about in this paper. You know, in some sense, the era of low media competition, where you had these three broadcasters, was an era that promoted less sensational, less inflammatory, kind of less attention-grabbing coverage. And in an era where you're just kind of competing over every last eyeball, you know, you have to do really sensational, inflammatory things, otherwise no one's going to watch you. You know, expanding media choice as a regulation that's been discussed a lot recently, it's not so clear that that's going to have an effect. But as Shaked says, you know, every regulation kind of has a flip side, right? So the flip side of limited competition is that those few outlets can be captured by ideological partisan actors. And there's a lot of concern that that's exactly what's happening now with Brendan Carr at the FCC and recent attempts to kind of give away TikTok to Oracle and the Ellisons. It's really not clear that there's kind of a panacea, that there's a silver bullet lying either kind of within economics or on the legal side. Our hope needs to be, again, going back to this distinction between the demand and the supply side, that changes happen on the demand side in politics that can then get us out of this self-reinforcing equilibrium into a different equilibrium in which there's just less polarization on both the political side and in terms of media content. And if we can move in that direction, the sort of feedback loop can push us back toward an equilibrium a little closer to what we used to have before this fragmentation of attention and fragmentation of politics.
Well, for my part, I think greater civics education earlier and maybe some national system of education that would provide a better education to people who are living in areas where property taxes are used to fund schools and maybe have fewer opportunities for the kind of education that somebody can afford, like an Exeter Andover or something could experience, would be a good thing and would probably go a long way, I think, to allowing people to have a better judgment and discerning what they're watching and whether or not it's worth their attention or maybe even to find other interests. I don't know. But I'll put both of you in charge of that. And I will hope that you'll solve all of our problems and that the next time we see you when you've done another wonderful study, are you guys going to do something else together?
We're working on social media now. So building on this study, trying to understand what explains the effects of social media on mental health. And so part of this is about politics, but a lot of it is about just trying to understand what's going on in terms of these like really horrific declines in mental health you see starting at around 2012, especially among young people and especially among young girls.
Well, I think people like Jonathan Haidt would probably welcome another study. I know he's tried to do a lot in that. I think, and you know, I'm seeing a lot of recent studies now focusing more on boys as well. So something that focuses on girls is probably very welcome. I really appreciate what you guys did here, and I want to see the next thing you do, and I wish you both luck. This was great. We're going to hyperlink the study in the notes to the cast. It looks long when you open it, but I want you to understand that there are ways to read this that won't suck you into the vortex, and I think you should. So click on the notes in the cast. The study is called The Business of the Culture War. So thank you for listening to NSLT. Be sure to subscribe to NSLT on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or Amazon. You can like and share this episode with a friend. Remember, a key feature of our national security, and when we can't agree, it's our unity, because we can agree to listen to each other. And that's one of the purposes of this podcast. We remain fortunate to live in a country with greater diversity of thought than any other, in my view. And that's a good thing. So the writer, producer, and host of NSLT is me, Elisa Poteet, always here in my individual capacity. Our editor, my co-producer is Francis Burkham. My other co-producer is the ever lovely Holly McMahon. Our program manager is Antasia Hawkins-Blakeney. Social media research support comes from Alana Coopersmith. And I just want to thank, as I always do, the brilliant minds of the members of the Standing Committee on Law and National Security who pursue the good in the interest of national security without regard to politics or party and with a consistent emphasis on education. We'll see you next time. Thanks for listening.
The views expressed on National Security Law Today have not been approved by the House of Delegates or the Board of Governors of the American Bar Association, and this recording should not be construed as representing ABA policy.